Hey, good evening. This is Rabbi Feldman Shear. It's Tuesday evening, September 16th. Tonight's Shear is sponsored by Ellen and Richard Gertler in honor of the birth of their grandson, Moshe Shmuel Grunsbach.
Still working off Parshas Shoftim. Can only imagine if we didn't go through every mitzvah and kishase, it'll be backlogged for a while. But I wanted to go back to Parshas Shoftim for a minute and talk a little bit about the thorny question of rabbinic authority and how exactly it's derived, where exactly it comes from. It's a topic of great debate, and it's a very complicated question. We know that we believe that we have laws that come to us from the Torah, called those dinim d'oraisa, and we have laws that come to us from the rabbis that are essentially man-made. There are a few other categories as well, kind of in between. We mentioned in the past we have a category called Divrei Kabbalah, which would signify things that are essentially man-made as well, but are given an extra status because they are mentioned in Psukim, not Psukim in Chumash, but Psukim in Tanakh, Psukim in Tanakh rather, and that gives it a status of perhaps a status comparable to Divrei Torah. So we have a couple of in-betweens, a couple of other categories. But in general, though, we have our mitzvahs in the Torah, and we have mitzvahs in the, from the rabbis, mitzvahs to Rabbanim. So the question always comes up, so why am I obligated to listen to what the rabbis say? So why, where does that come in? We know that we all stood at Har Sinai, and we received the Torah, and the Torah is coming directly from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so we're committed to that. That we understand. But the idea that we have to not only follow them, but we have to follow the rabbis as well, so where does that come from? So that was a topic of tremendous debate among the aforementioned rabbis. But on the one hand, the Rambam took the view, and he expresses this in his Mishneh Torah and Hilchos Mamrim, that it all derives from Parshas Shoftim, from what we read 2 weeks ago. And there the Torah tells us it's going to happen. It's going to happen that you're not going to know what to do. You're going to try to follow the Torah's laws, and you're going to be stumped by something. You're not going to be sure what the requirements are, what the prohibitions are, either way. So what should you do? So the Torah tells us there'll be certain authorities at that time. Whether it's the Shofet or the Kohen or whatever it is, there'll be some clear authoritative structure. And you'll go to that place and you will ask the question. And then when you receive the answer, so v'ashisa kasha yarucha, so you're obligated to follow the answer. Torah tells us, so we shouldn't deviate from that which the Torah tells us, not to the right or to the left. Now, it's not really what I'm going to focus on, but just to mention it because we brought it up. So this last clause over here, right or left, is a very, very troubling phrase. A phrase that the Rashi over there that's very hard to understand. It prompted a lot of discussion. The Rashi says it means that even if they tell you that right is left and left is right, so you still have to listen to them. Rabbi Shechter has mentioned on occasion that when Herman Wouk used to teach in Yeshiva University, so he said that his book, The Kain Mutiny, is based on Rashi and Chumash. You see from this Rashi and Chumash that authority is always right no matter what, and there you go. Even if they tell you right is left, left is right, that's it. So Rabbi Shechter then asks, is the wrong shot in Rashi and Chumash? It can't be what Rashi means, because the problem is that's against the Masechta in Shas. That we have a whole Masechta which is called Harius. It's not the biggest Masechta, it's the shortest Masechta, but it's a Masechta which essentially tells us, but you know, from the Psukim, that it's possible for the Sanhedrin to make a mistake. It's possible for them to say the wrong thing. And this is very complicated territory, that if we know that it's the wrong thing, then we're not supposed to follow it. So it's not really true that if they say, tell you left is right and right is left, now you're supposed to follow them if you really know that left is right and right is left. So as he explains, it probably means that it's not that you really know that it's wrong. It's that you don't understand it. You're not, if you haven't learned enough, it doesn't seem to you like you're that well versed. So then, and you don't really understand it, so then you should still trust it anyway. Remember he gave the example saying that, let's say somebody says, Rabbi, can I drink tea on Yom Kippur? The rabbi will say, no, you can't drink on Yom Kippur. You can't have tea on Yom Kippur. So the person says, Rabbi, you're wrong. You're a crazy ultra-Orthodox rabbi because I know that I'm not supposed to eat before davening. but I can have tea before davening. So it must be that having tea is not called eating. So if I can't eat on Yom Kippur, I'm still allowed to have tea. So you might come to that conclusion because you haven't learned the halachas well enough, so you don't know the difference between eating before davening and eating on Yom Kippur. So it looks to you like it's a totally wrong tzach, but if you knew more, you would realize. But you really know that you know. You know, not only do you think you know, but you know that you know. You know there's mamish mistake here. So then it seems to be that the halacha is that you're not supposed to follow it. And again, it's very, very complicated hashkafic territory. And other Rishonim have differently. Rabbi Chaim Wasserman has in his essays, this will be referred to later also, that maybe this is a reference to the idea, which I think we've talked about in the past, that Yesh Koach B'Chachamim Lakar Davim Benatar B'Sheva Al Taisa, that we know that sometimes the rabbis really do tell you against the Torah, that the Torah says blow shofar whatever day of the week it is, when it's Rosh Hashanah, and the rabbis say no, don't listen. So the rabbis sometimes have a right to say, yeah, the Torah says do this, so we're telling you not to do that. So occasionally there will be a time where they'll tell you really the opposite of what the Torah says, and you'll have to listen. So maybe that's what the reference is. So that whole last clause there, Yom Rasmol, is a topic of a lot of analysis, a lot of discussion. We don't know exactly how to relate to that part. There are different rushes for that as well. It's a whole theme in and of itself. But Rashi is quoting a Chazal somewhere. Not a Gemara, it's a Medrash. I think I have to check again where Rashi is getting it from. But in any case, this is the topic I saw by David Horowitz from why you started writing philosophical discussions of the Parish. I think this is the first thing he talked about, this what this Rashi means, what this whole pasuk means, the nature of authority. So you can take a look. I think it's available on Why You Tell It. So that's a whole interesting topic in and of itself. But the Rambam says that this section here of following what the Chazal says, he says that's how you know that you have to follow the mitzvahs of Rabbanan. So this tells us that the rabbis can say you should light Hanukkah candles and you shouldn't eat the shalakim and certain things that are not commanded or prohibited by the Torah. The rabbis can come and tell you you have to do them or you have to stay away from them, whichever the appropriate terminology is, and you have to listen. The pasuk says, well, sus. So this is a very controversial position. And the Ramban primarily, and others disagree with this, and the Ramban has a whole host of questions on it. But he can break down his questions into categories. First of all, one could argue that there's just no proof from the text. If we look at the American model of government, so we have a very distinct separation of powers. So we know that we have president, executive, but besides that we have the legislative branch and the judiciary. And the legislature and the judiciary are very intentionally two completely separate branches. So the legislature will make the laws, and the judiciary is going to interpret the laws. And if a judge tries to legislate, he gets criticized for that because it's not the judge's job to tell you what he thinks the law should be. He's only supposed to tell you what he thinks the law is. He's not allowed to come and say, this should be the law. And so, too, the legislature, they're only there to give you the new laws. They're not able to say what the existing laws mean as far as their opinion tells you. So all we really see from the Pesukim, one could argue, is that there is judiciary authority given to the rabbis. That somebody's trying to follow the Torah, he doesn't know what the Torah says. So he comes to the rabbis, he says, tell me what it means. And they answer him, and their authority is binding. That much we know. But the idea that they can make up something new, that's not contained in the Pesukim. The idea that they can say, yeah, the Torah doesn't say that you have to light Hanukkah candles, but we think you should, or the Torah doesn't prohibit chicken and milk, but we think you should stay away from it. So how do you know that from the Pesukim? So, first of all, that's one level of question one could raise against Rambam's position. Simply, it's not there in the text, all of what he's trying to draw upon. There are a lot of other technical objections. There are certain proofs from the Gemara one could bring one direction or the other. For example, one passage that you might quote as a source really for either position is the passage the Gemara has in Sefer Brachos on Daf Chaf for the discussion of Kavod Abrius. The Gemara says that Kavod Abrius is such a powerful idea, human dignity is such an important priority, that it can push away a lo sasei from the Torah. So Gemara says, really, a lo sasei? We just said before in the passage there that's not true. So Gemara says, well, it's one specific lo sasei, and that's lo sasei. It can push away lo sasei. In that context, the Gemara says, that kol milei d'rabbanan asmechuhu alav lo sasei. That all of the, this is a reference to dinim drabanan. So it sounds like a good proof for the Rambam. Sounds like exactly what he said, that Lo Sasser tells us the extra laws in drabanan. But it uses this language, asmahu. So one could read that, as the Ramban does, as saying that it's an asmachta, that we don't really mean that this is a reference to actually prohibiting the dinim drabanan, or the serum drabanan. But rather, it's a hint. It's a remez to dinim drabanan. It's not the actual source. So sources like that are also brought into discussion to read it this way, to read it that way. But a whole other level of question that the Ramban asks, and this is a topic of tremendous discussion, is there's a conceptual problem that we believe that we have distinctions in practice between dinim deraisa and dinim derabanan. The most well known perhaps is the rule that safek deraisa lechumra and safek derabanan lekula. Many other distinctions also, but let's use that as the most prominent one, that if we're not sure how the halacha should be applied, so if it's a matter of a safek from Torah law, so we're machmir, if it's derabanan, so we're mekel. So how can we distinguish? According to the Rambam, essentially, all the mitzvahs derabanan are really mitzvahs min ha-Torah. Not only are they mitzvahs min ha-Torah, they're lo saseh min ha-Torah. It's a Torah prohibition to not follow within the derabanan. So it's actually a relatively severe concept min ha-Torah. So what right would we have to be lenient in applying rabbinical law? So there are essentially two schools of thought that can be brought in here, two broader schools, a lot of answers that are given, but just to speak broadly, there are, say, two schools of thought. One is the, you might call the umbrella theory, and the idea that, yes, there is a concept that rabbinical authority, including legislative authority, comes from Lo Sasser. But that doesn't mean that every principle of rabbinic law is a din min ha-Torah and should be treated with all the stringencies of the din min ha-Torah. The Mesech Chachma has a parable, the Mesech Chachma has a comparison. So let's say you have a king who has a prince, and the king says that I want that all the people should respect my son, the prince. I want that he should be taken seriously and you should listen to him. So the king's authority is behind the prince, but if the prince says something, it's not the same thing as the king saying it, it's the prince talking. Happens to be that the king is putting his weight behind him. So there's an umbrella coverage here, but it's not that it becomes the same thing. It's not that it becomes the word of the king. Or to give a more relatable example, let's say you have a school, so the school will have a principal and will have teachers. So the principal backs up the teachers, and the teacher tells the students to do something, so it's enforceable because the principal is going to step in and make sure that the kids listen to him. But it doesn't mean that everything the teacher says is what the principal says. They're still clearly separate entities, and the principal still clearly has a whole different level of authority than the teacher's. But the teacher's authority comes from the fact that they're hired by the principal, and the principal is going to back them up and he's going to support them. So too, it could be that that's what the Rambam is saying, that we are obligated to listen to the Rabbanans because the Torah says Lo Sasser, but they don't have to make the stretch to believe that therefore that makes all the Rabbanans into Dinim Deraisa. And the truth is, you see that the Rambam seems to have this attitude in contrast to other Rishonim, the Rishonim who go farther than him, and who actually do seem to really attach Deraisa status to the Rabbanans. For example, in the question of Minyan HaMitzvos, when it comes to counting the Mitzvos, so the Rambam writes as one of his rules that he's not going to count the Rabbanans as part of the 613 mitzvahs, but there are others among the Monian mitzvahs who do count in the Rabbanan. Or, for example, as the Gemara raises the issue, the Gemara says, how can we recite a bracha on it in the Rabbanan? How can we say, Asher Kedushanu b'mitzvosu v'tzivanu? That's the question of how can we justify the bracha, but the language of the bracha doesn't work. The bracha says that we were commanded. So the Gemara Masechta Shabbos, in the context of Neres Chanukah, raises the question, Tehechan Sivanu, so whoever commanded us, God never told us to light Chanukah candles. So the Gemara explains different possible sources, how it translates to a Tivoy from the Kodesh Baruch Hu. But the Rambam seems to go out of his way in his formulation of the bracha when he talks about this, and he says that, what do we mean when we say this? He says, what we mean is Asher Kedushanu Mitzvosa V'Tzivanu Lishmo Alelu, who commanded us to listen to the ones who said to light Hanukkah candles. So we're not saying that God commanded us to light Hanukkah candles, we're saying that God commanded, the missing phrase there which you have to put in brackets, God commanded us to listen to those who said that we should light Hanukkah candles. So there are certain indications that's really what the Rambam means. The Rambam understands it in this Klolistic sense, and there are Rishonim to contrast with who would go even farther than he would. So that's one approach, the approach that we're really just talking about, a broad umbrella kind of thought. Another approach that you can take is what you would call the Kach Tiknu approach, which would say that Chazal set it up that way. That in other words, yes, they really have the right to insist on Suffolk Devarim and Mahatmer. They're really left in a default position. If we didn't know how the law should apply, it would be stringent, it would be Lechumra, because essentially it would trace back to Los Osir. However, Chazal went out of their way, and Chazal reduced their own power, and they said that we're only going to insist on the Vados. We're only going to require you to follow our law in definite circumstances. We're not going to take advantage of the whole range of Chumra that could be open to us. So why would they do that? Why would they reduce the scope of their own enactments? So here, this also breaks down into two other schools. It can break down with one theory into two schools at least. So one of them is that they were concerned about another issue that we read about recently in the parsha, recently twice in the recent weeks, and that is that we have a prohibition of Baal Tosef. We're not allowed to add on to the Torah. And there is quite an extensive literature on this question of if the Torah tells us don't add, so how is it that we have this whole rabbinic literature with Chazal essentially adding, Chazal telling us more mitzvos, which seems to fly in the face of Baal Tosef. So Baal Tosef is really its own discussion, its own extensive discussion. It's fascinating because there really is quite a machlokas among the Rishonim. What is the simple translation of the phrase? What is the basic scope of Baal Tosef? What does it refer to? So that's a whole topic of analysis. But the Rambam's position, as he expresses it in Hilchos Mamrim, and therefore will be consistent with this idea, the Rambam's position is that essentially Chazal can tell us to do new dinim, Chazal can add on new mitzvos, but they have to be clear that they're not telling us what the Torah says. That the problem would essentially be that if they would pass off their mitzvos as mitzvos min haTorah, that would be a problem with Baal Tosef. But if they make new halachas, but they tell us what it is, they don't try to present it as a din deraisa, so then that's okay. And it gives the example I mentioned before, chicken and milk. So really, chicken and milk is mutter min haTorah, and Rabbi Yossi really felt it was mutter completely. And the Torah only prohibits beef and milk, meat and milk. And yet, Chazal said we're afraid that chicken is too similar, so we're going to prohibit chicken as well. So says the Rambam, that's okay, they can do that, as long as they don't give you the impression that that's a din min haTorah. If they don't tell you that the Torah prohibits chicken and milk, so that's okay. The Ravid doesn't like this whole interpretation. The Ravid argues on him, and he doesn't accept that that's what it means. There was a famous episode involving Reb Chaim Brisker. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was asked about a certain community in Europe that was approaching Pesach time, and there was some kind of a famine there. Mamish didn't have any food, but they had very little food. And the bulk of what they had, most of the food that they had access to, was kidneys. So the question was asked, should they adhere to the Ashkenazi practice of not eating kidneys on Pesach, even in a situation where it would be such a phenomenal hardship? We have to assume that it wasn't a situation of Pikuach Nefesh, and it wouldn't be a question, it would have been a phenomenal hardship. So Reb Chaim, like he said in another context, it wasn't Mekil, he was Matma. He says, you have to eat kidneys. He says, not from a perspective of Kula, from a perspective of Chumra, that not only are you entitled to be lenient in such a situation of extreme need, but if you're not going to be lenient, if you're going to insist on being machmir about this, it's a problem of Baal Tosef. Then you're basically saying that you treat this minig like a din min haTorah, and there's no distinction. So that would be a serious problem. So perhaps that's what's going on, that Chazal chose to change the scope of their authority in order to preserve the distinction. So it's the jury's still out on whether this is effective. On the one hand, you could say it does kind of work, because any time you talk about a concept in halacha, so the fact of whether it's deraisa or the rabbanon always have to play a role in discussion, because it is going to be applied differently. So because there's these differences, so any time you want to paskin a question, you have to always talk about whether it's deraisa or the rabbanon, because you have to know how it's applied practically. So one could argue that this is a very effective reminder that differences in halacha do help preserve the distinction and make us always remember and forced to return to the fact that they're essentially Drabbanans. On the other hand, it's a little hard to reconcile that with the fact that half of Shas is about trying to figure out whether something is a Deraisa or Drabbanan. And so many things are a topic of a machlokes, a topic of unresolved questions, so whether they're Deraisa or Drabbanan. So it's hard to swallow that that distinction is so crucial, and yet it's broken down in so many dozens of instances. Going back to the Shas already, that's a little bit of a difficult position on that angle. Okay, and that goes back to a question of the Rambam statement itself, whether or not that's the reason. So that's one sub-explanation of Kaf Tiknu. It could be that they set their rules up like this because it effectively saves us from Baltosif. The other approach is that Kaf Tiknu, they set it up like this because that's all that's necessary. That essentially, if the purpose of Dinim Darabanan are essentially different than Dinim Daraisa, that they're not really there because they're bad. It's not really, a Din Darabanan is not prohibited because it's something bad to do, but it's prohibited because it might lead to something else. It's prohibited as a safeguard, and something we'll go into more in a few minutes. So then one could argue that we don't need to prohibit even the Sfeikis. We don't have to say, stay away from this because it's going to lead to that, and stay away even from a situation that might be this. It's enough to say, stay away from a situation that you know is this, because that might lead you down to that. But if you don't even know that it's that to begin with, so then that's already a step removed from leading us to the next one. So that could be, and we'll explain this a little bit more in a few minutes, that could be perhaps another reason why Chazal Taftiknu, because they didn't feel a need to burden us more than they have to. This was enough to accomplish their goals. The idea is building a fence. The fence is high enough. The fence doesn't have to be higher than that. The fence only has to be so high you can't climb over. It doesn't have to be high enough that you can't fly over with a helicopter. It doesn't have to be such a fence. So that's another angle. So these are some of the approaches that have been taken to explain the Rambam. There's much more written about this as well. But the problem is, so let's say you accept the Ramban's position. You say, I don't accept any of these answers. The Ramban's question is a great question, and therefore the Rambam's wrong. So you're left with a bigger problem. So then, okay, Ramban, so I'll go to your side, but now what do I do? Why do I follow the Dinim D'Rabbanan? So what is the source? And the problem is, the Ramban, part of some of his questions were effectively indicating a Los Osir as a source. But this most recent question doesn't just negate Los Osir, it negates everything. It means any pasuk is going to be a problem, because any pasuk also is going to trace back to a Din D'Oraisa, and then what are you going to do? And there are some who argue that Buchanan has this whole essay about this in his Kovit Shiurim. There's a section called the Kunches Divrei Sofrim, where he focuses on concepts D'Rabbanan. Even Divrei Sofrim is a complicated phrase. The Rambam uses that phrase. We usually take it to assume he means Dinim D'Rabbanan, but there also it's not clear. Sometimes he uses it for Dinim that we assume to be a Din D'Oraisa, and it's often understood that what he means is that these are halachas that you need Chazal to explain, that either they wouldn't have existed without Chazal, or we wouldn't have understood the drasha, we wouldn't have understood the pasuk by itself, and we need Chazal to tell us that's what the pasuk means. So whatever it is, we have this idea of Divrei Sofrim. So the Buchanan has an essay called a number of essays, four or five essays called Kunches Divrei Sofrim, in which he gets into this, and he says, even if you want to say that we're dealing with a Svara, so that's problematic, because the Gemara basically tells us that a Svara has the same authority as a Pasuk. The Gemara says in the context of Hamotzin and Chaver or all of Araya, certain halachas which are derived from logic, derived from Svara. The Gemara has a sentence, Lama Likra Svarahu, why don't I need a pasuk? It's obvious. So as they explain, the answer would probably be, well, I need a pasuk to make it a Din Minat Torah. So you see that, you don't. You see that if it's logically compelling, it will have equal authority as if it's actually spelled out in the Torah. So that's how Buchanan and others point out that even if you can say, well, it's not a pasuk, but there's some Svarah, so the Svarah itself is going to have a power of the notary back to the same question, back to the same issue of Safik Rabbanim should be Lachomim. So there's a lot written about this. There is an idea of Rabbeinu David as a Talmud of the Ramban, and we've shown him. he has a notion, and others do as well, that it's a concept of neder, that essentially Klal Yisrael commits themselves to accepting these principles. The Hesaris Tshuva, Kiva Eger's descendant, has a whole tshuva about this, where he expresses various problems why he doesn't think this is the correct approach. But it does explain certain things that we know, that we have a rule that if Chazal make a gzera and Eina Tzibur Yochel Lamad Bo, and it didn't take, if the Tzibur didn't adopt it, so then it doesn't hold. So essentially there is such a concept that the Klal Yisrael has to come in and say, yes, we accept it. So that could follow some type of neder idea, that we willingly commit ourselves to these principles, and if indeed there's an opt-out clause, that if it doesn't take, it doesn't take, and maybe that's working along those theories. The idea that Rabbi Chanan does like is the notion that HaKadosh Baruch Hu essentially signs off on whatever Chazal say. That we find this idea by Moshe Rabbeinu. The Gemara tells us that the number of things that Moshe Rabbeinu did, the Hiskim HaKadosh Baruch Hu Al Yado, that God agreed afterwards that that was a good idea. So presumably the same is true about Chazal also, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we can assume they know what they're doing, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu therefore comes in and signs off on it, so that gives it the authority. That's where it then goes back to that whole muscle of the king. The king then says, yes, it's a good law. Which is interesting also as far as that parable is concerned. So Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes in his Tshuvas that that's shot in the Ramban, the same shot that we mentioned before in the Ramban. He says he thinks that's what the Ramban means. If he says the Ramban agrees that Lo Sasser is really a source for Dinim Derabbanan, but he just disagrees that according to him the Rambam does take the more extreme view that we didn't attribute to him before, that it becomes Dinim Deraisa with this status, and the Ramban sees it more as a clause, because that there is an idea that Lo Sasser applies to general authority, and the Pratim have their own independent status. There are some who suggest that maybe one could say that one is only in violation of Lo Sasser if one violates Din Derabanan B'Shita. That if one says, if one wants to have a chicken cheeseburger, so if he says, I'm just passing, I'm so hungry, I know it's prohibited, but I'm going to have it anyway, so then there are some who argue that's not a violation of Lo Sasser, that's a violation of Din Derabanan. But if somebody says, yeah, I'm going to eat this, because what right do the rabbis have to tell me what to do? I don't have to follow their authority. So then that becomes Lo Sasser. That becomes a rebellion against the authority. That's how the Achronim understand it's an Isser Meriz. The Isser is one of rebellion, not specifically to Aser the Dinim themselves from the power of the Dinim Atar. So that comes up in a theory that you find in a lot of Achronim, a very popular theory, which not everybody accepted, but a lot of the Gachronim did. And it's attributed first to the Nesivus HaMishpat. The Nesivus HaMishpat, in his commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch, and Siman Reish Lamed Daled, has an idea which a lot of Gachronim did sign on to, that there's a fundamental difference between, let's focus on an Isser, there's a fundamental difference between a prohibition in HaTorah and a prohibition in Drabbanim. And it uses terminology that became popular in brisker circles, and it only comes up really once in the Talmud, in the beginning of Maseches Nedarim, so we're introduced to a distinction between a Chefza and a Gavra. So in brisker lumdus, this is a very popular phrase, in Shas it's only really in that one place, that sometimes we have a halacha that applies to an object, we call that an Isser Chefza, and labels an object as good or bad or whatever, and sometimes we have an instruction to the individual, we call that and it's a gavra. The truth of the terminology sounds very loose. It sounds like you can play with it however you want. The Abinezer has an interesting tshuva where he writes that he says, come on, let's get real. Every Isser is both a chesta and a gavra, however you want to focus on, so what does this distinction mean? And he has a very nice interpretation there, which we could talk about if that was our focus. But essentially, the Nesivus doesn't actually say this. The later Achronim interpreted the Nesivus this way. So even if the Nesivus meant this, a little bit of a question. But the idea is as follows, that if somebody were to consume an Isser Deraisa, they were going to consume non-kosher food, and he were to do it b'shogeg, he doesn't do it on purpose, So he's not technically punishable if you don't do it on purpose. You can't be held responsible for something you do b'shogeg. But we do have a concept of a kapara for shogeg, that if somebody encountered an issa d'oraisa, even if he didn't do it willingly, so maybe he doesn't get punished, but he does have to fix it, he does have to atone, that there is this idea that there's a spiritual stain that's going to come from the avera, and that has to be cleaned up. So the notion that the Nesivis seems to say, as interpreted by others, is that this wouldn't be true if we're dealing with a d'rabbanan, that an issa d'rabbanan, the shogeg, doesn't need a kapara. That means it doesn't need any tshuva, that's how the discussion then flows from there. Does that mean it doesn't need any kind of repentance, or just it doesn't need an atonement? So that's a question. But there's the idea that he doesn't need a kapara. So the explanation that they give, you know, Samech and Chassam Sofer and others, a lot of big achronim have this idea, that it means that when you're dealing with an issur d'oraisa, so the object is bad. You have a piece of chazra. So God says this is bad for you. It's spiritually hurtful. So it's wrong for you to choose to eat it. That's an avera, and you could be punished for doing that. And even if you didn't do it on purpose, it's still harmful. It's still problematic. God said this chetza is bad. God created the world. God wrote the Torah. It's all one thing. Therefore, this is spiritually problematic. But when it comes to a din d'rabbanan, so this object was neutral. You have the chicken cheeseburger. So before the rabbis came along in Rabbi Yosef Abdulai's neighborhood, this was neutral. There's no inherent badness here. So why am I not allowed to eat it? I'm not allowed to eat it because I can't rebel against Chazal. Chazal told me not to. So what kind of isser is that? So that's an isser gavra. That's an isser of rebelling. I can't ignore Chazal. But Chazal have no authority over the chicken cheeseburger. They can't turn this into something bad. If it was neutral before, it's neutral now. Their authority doesn't extend to that. Their authority extends to me. It extends to the Jewish people. So the Jews have to listen. The Jews have to stay away. But the object, you can't tell me, has any metaphysical quality to it. It wasn't there before. So therefore, the assumption seems to be that that's an isser gavra. This is an instruction to the individual. And it's not necessarily to be understood as a isser chesed. So if one were to accidentally consume an issur d'rabbanan, so the notion would be there's no need for tshuva. He doesn't have to get punished because he did it by accident, and he doesn't have to atone either. There doesn't have to be anything fixed because there wasn't anything bad in the object. The whole problem was rebelling, and if you did it by accident, that's not called rebelling. You know? So therefore, there would be no aver at all. There's nothing to fix. There isn't any problem whatsoever. Which would then again be consistent with the idea of Safek Rabbanan Makula. One could say that if you know it on purpose, then that's a problem. You know, then when you're dealing with din d'oraisa, it's bad for you. So you want to stay away from it because it's like there might be poison there. So you want to stay away from the poison. Even if you're not sure there's poison, you think there might be poison, so you want to stay away from the poison. But here the problem is you're not supposed to rebel. So if you don't know that it's there, so you're not rebelling. You're acting at a suffix, and then you could argue that you are protected. The Mincha Salazar writes that that's also the reason that we have a concept of Ein Gozer and Gezeira LeGezeira. And that there is a notion that Chazal only make one level of prohibition. They don't make a prohibition for one of their own prohibitions. It's a little bit of a question whether that means they're not allowed to, or whether it's just the way they act, if they don't make such a Gezeira. So the Mincha Salazar explains that idea based on this. Why did Chazal make gezeiras at all? So gezeiras are essentially to protect us from the shogeg. If a person wants to do an avera on purpose, so he's going to do it one way or another, he's going to ignore the d'rabbanan. But if a person is at risk of doing an avera the shogeg, that's where the d'rabbanan comes in. The d'rabbanan sets up a barrier between the avera the shogeg and the person. So if that's the case, so then that is the Minchas Lazer based on this reading of the Nesivis, that there's no point in having a gezeira or a gezeira, because what's the point of the gezeira, the new gezeira? To stop you from accidentally violating a din d'rabbanan. But if you accidentally violate a din d'rabbanan, so it doesn't count anyway. So then what's the point in stopping you from accidentally violating a din d'rabbanan based on this reading of the Nesivis? So again, there were those who didn't really feel the Nesivis meant that, and there were those who felt that the whole shita was wrong. Perhaps the most prominent of the later authors who took this position was Rabbi Yosef Engel. Rabbi Yosef Engel has a piece in his Ashton Dereisha, where he doesn't like the whole Rishach Chatzah Kavah thing. He has a lot of issues with certain distinctions between this is man, or permanent Yisurim, and temporary Yisurim. The idea that a temporary Yisur isn't Nisur Chatzah, he takes issue with it. He has a whole piece about this whole notion. And there he takes his stance that Nisur Rabbanan also can be a Nisur Chatzah. He doesn't believe that that's something that's limited to an Nisur Dereisha. And it's very similar to what we saw before from Rabbi Chanan, that the idea is that a Kadosh Baruch Hu is maskim, a Kadosh Baruch Hu signs off on whatever it is the Chazal decide to prohibit. So if the rabbis make a new prohibition, so a Kadosh Baruch Hu says, okay, I endorse that. And even though it was neutral a minute ago, once they make their prohibition, so now it's essentially an Isser Chesed, and God comes in and changes the status of the item based on their ruling. That's how Rav Yosef Engel understood.
Well, isn't there a section of
So that's very much the point. If we're dealing with Torah law, so then accidental violation is a problem. Violation needs an atonement, and that's contrasted with rabbinical law. But when the rabbis make a law, so then they made a mistake in interpreting Torah law. So because of their mistake, Torah law was violated. So if Torah law was violated by accident, so even if it's not punishable in the sense of Malkus or Mises or something like that, but it's punishable in the sense that it has to be atoned for. It has to be fixed. The spiritual stain has to be clean. But when it comes to a din derabbanan, so that might be a whole different. If the rabbis made up the law to begin with, that might be a whole different status, which affects a number of other issues. Just to mention an interesting example, there is a Rabbi Wasserman has an observation in his Sefer on Yivamis from the Kovetz Aris. There is a Tosus from the Sechet Yivamis has a very hard idea to understand. The Tosus says that we know that a Kohen is not allowed to be in the same house as a mace. There's a Tumah, a level of a mace, so a Kohen is not allowed to be in the same house. So what happens if the Kohen finds out that there's a dead body in the house? So he's got to run. He's got to get out of there as quick as possible. So Tosfos says, what if it's not a mace, but it's a tumah on a level of the Rabbanan? You have a tumah of the Rabbanan, so the Kohen is not supposed to be in contact with that either. So Tosfos says, well, yeah, he doesn't have to run. He can walk. What does that mean? The fact that Varecho Shirin, so we'll put a speedometer on him. And if it's a Dereisha, he's got to run at a certain speed. If it's the Rabbanan, so he can walk at a lower speed. So what does that mean? So Bochanan explains what it means. He says that there is a fundamental difference between a Dereisha and a Rabbanan. So a Dereisha is an Isser Chatzah. The Torah is basically saying that for a Kohen to be in a house with a dead body, that hurts him. That's spiritually problematic. So he's got to get out of there as quick as possible to not be in contact with this spiritual danger. But when it comes to the Din Rabbanan, so there isn't really any problem in the Chatzah itself. There's no problem in the object. It's a Chazal told him he has to leave. So he can't rebel by saying that. But if he's walking, if he's leaving, so then he's not rebelling. So it doesn't matter how fast he's running, it doesn't matter how fast he's walking, he's still in compliance, and that's okay. An example one might use is the difference between a fire and a fire drill. And if there's a fire in the house, God forbid, so people want to run out of the house as quickly as possible because they don't want to get burnt by the fire. But if there's a fire drill, so they still have to go through all the motions, they have to follow all the rules, but nobody's really going to run because they know that there's no fire. They know that they're just leaving because they have to be compliant, they have to be obedient, so they're going to leave the house. So too, if there was a real Dereisha, so that's like a fire, he's got to run out of there to avoid the danger. But if it's a Din Derabbanan, so the rule is he has to comply, he has to cooperate. So when he cooperates, he's okay, it doesn't matter how fast it's going. Without getting into the whole discussion, you know, at that time, but this does relate also, and this is a whole hour in of itself, but just on the surface, that we know that when we deal with the question of, we mentioned before, Akiras Dava Minatara, the idea that Chazal can uproot Din Minatara, so let's again use the famous example, so Chazal tell us that we shouldn't blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. And even though the Torah says when Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, in general we're in favor. But when Rosh Hashanah falls out on Shabbos, so Chazal tells us not to blow shofar. And according to the Torah, you are supposed to blow shofar. So Rabbi Chanan Wasserman again has a very famous piece about this. It's probably the most famous piece in the Sefer Ani Bamas, where he raises the question, but what does that mean? What does that mean when we say that Chazal can tell us not to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah and Shabbos? So does it mean that the mitzvah has been canceled, that there is no longer any obligation to blow shofar on Shabbos? And like Rabbi Akiva Eger has a whole discussion that if one does, he's not even going to fulfill a mitzvah, it's absolutely nothing. Or are we going to say that, no, there is a mitzvah, they can't change what the Torah says. The Torah says blow shofar, so there is a mitzvah. And maybe if one would blow shofar against the rules, he still would perhaps fulfill a mitzvah. But the rabbi said, in spite of the fact that there is a mitzvah, we're telling you not to do it, which really goes to the question of what does this language mean? This is lakor davar matara, sounds very extreme, to uproot something from the Torah. So is that really what they're doing? Can they really uproot something from the Torah? It's not there anymore? Or that no, it doesn't really mean that. It means that in practice, they can tell you not to do it, but it's still there. It still has everything associated with it, and Chazal are telling you not to do it. So the truth is, this corresponds very much with the two positions, the position of the Nesivus and the position of Yosef Engel. That the idea of the Nesivus, the same way the rabbis don't really change the status of the item that was neutral before is neutral now, they can't create a Nesir Chatza, so presumably that's the same thing, they can't rewrite the Torah either. Their authority is on the individual has to listen to them, but they can't change objects and they can't change the Torah. So therefore, there is still a mitzvah to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, but they have the ability to say, don't pay attention to that mitzvah, don't observe that mitzvah. Stay home and passively skip on this mitzvah. While if you take Rav Yosef Engel's more extreme view, the idea that there can be an Issa Chesed because the Kadosh Baruch Hu signs off on it, and now it has this status as a real bona fide object of Issa, so maybe the same thing could be true here also, that Chazal make a gzeri, you shouldn't blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah when it falls out on Shabbos. And the Kodesh Baruch Hu's maskim, okay, now it's not a mitzvah anymore. Now there's no din of blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah when it falls out on Shabbos. And if one were to do it, you're not going to fulfill anything. It's not a concept anymore. So there's a lot to say about that. Bachanan has a fascinating piece following all the ins and outs of how that works. But essentially, just to point out, it seems to boil down to these two questions, which then all comes back to the initial question of how do we understand the pasuk of Los Asur? Are we saying that there is an obligation here to follow all dinim d'rabbanan as if they're dinim minat Torah? Or is there a broader principle saying we can't rebel against the Chazal, and it doesn't actually attach itself to the dinim that will come out of it? So again, there's a lot more to say about that. It's just a broad introduction, just to quickly chaz that we spoke about. So you mentioned that we have this whole passage in Parshas Shoftim tells us if we don't know what to do, we should ask the authority and we're obligated to follow that. We mentioned the whole controversy over what does it mean Yom and Ismol, Rashi's view, and the idea that David is talking about Lakadaz Manatari, Rabbi Chanan, and so I say about that. And then we talked about the fact that Rambam says that this is the source of the obligation to follow Dinam D'Rabbanan, and the Ramban disagreeing with that, that first of all we know from there is judiciary authority, we don't necessarily know legislative authority. The whole question how to interpret the passage in the Gemara Brachos about Kol Mili D'Rabbanan Asmachuhu Alav Losas, or is that a Raya from Rambam or from Ramban? How do you want to read it? And the essential question of how can we be makel, how can we be lenient if we have a suffix, if essentially all of these dinim are really dinim d'Rabbanan, so tracing back to Losas, and are actually prohibitions D'Rabbanan. So I mentioned some of the different approaches to defend the Rambam. One approach is the approach that the basic king-prince theory that we saw in the Meshach Chachma, that there's two levels of authority, that the king backs up the prince, but the prince is not actually the king, so not the things the prince says do not actually become statements of the king, but the king's authority backs him up. So that's one way to understand it. And then we mentioned the Kaftiknu theory, that maybe it was set up this way, that this is how it should be practiced. And even though the default would have been that even rabbinical law would have been stringent, but they themselves set it up to be lenient, they chose to make their laws lakula. Why should that be? So that breaks down into two theories. I mentioned the Baal Tosef possibility, that the Rambam takes the view that Baal Tosef means that you can't confuse things by making a Rabbanan sound like a Din D'Oraisa. And maybe this distinction is what keeps them apart. But the other idea of Kaf Tiknu is that if we assume that the Rabbanans are essentially there to protect us from violating a Din Minat Torah, so then this sense is enough. The prohibit of adults, which is the situation we know definitely is, that's enough. And then we discussed the question, if you don't accept the Rambam and you vote with the Ramban, so then why is there an obligation to listen to the Rabbanans? And we discussed the possibility that maybe it's Midin Nether, like Rabbeinu David suggests. We mentioned some of the objections to that that Shuvah and others raised. We discussed how even a Svara would also have the same problem as saying it's any Pasuk in the Torah, that you essentially have the same question about why should there be any distinctions in practice. And then we mentioned the idea that maybe it's a notion that HaKadosh Baruch Hu agrees, he signs on to whatever Chazal say, and after the fact he endorses it, and therefore it essentially becomes binding. And we talked about the machlokas between the Nesidus and the Seder Yosef Engel, but Nesidus seems to say, the way he was interpreted by others, that there's no status of an Isra Chetzah by Din Rabbanim, that the rabbis can't control the status of an object, that's only something that works by Din Minat Torah. And when it comes to Din Rabbanim, it's the prohibition to rebel, but if you're not doing, if you're actually rebelling, there's no prohibition, and therefore there wouldn't have to be an atonement for an Isra Rabbanim that was done accidentally. And then we discussed how that may affect certain things. Mentioned this angle disagrees, and this angle says that God does sign off on them afterwards, so it becomes a din d'oraisa. And we mentioned the Rav Chanan's whole explanation about the Tosfos and Yevamos that says if it's a tumah d'rabbanan, you don't have to run, you only have to walk, is because if it's a tumah d'oraisa, it's like a fire, you have to run away from it. If it's a tumah d'rabbanan, it's like a fire drill, you have to comply, you don't have to actually run because you're behaving, so you're not rebelling, that's enough. And then we just looked at how this may impact the famous question of Lakhar Davim and Atzara, the idea that the rabbis can tell you not to follow it in the Torah. So the question of Lachanan and others discussed, does that mean that it's absolutely cancelled as if it never was there? Or it's there, but the rabbis tell us to ignore it. That essentially lines up with the two positions of the Neshivas and the Joseph Engel. Do we say the rabbis only have authority over people? They can tell people, don't eat this food, but it's not inherently bad. They can tell people not to blow shofar on Shabbos, but it's still there in the Torah. Or do we say even more than that, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu agrees after the fact that it has that status, so therefore the food can become an Isra Chetzah if that's the case, and the Mitzvah of Shofar on Shabbos can be taken off the book because HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes and agrees after the fact. Okay, so we will stop there. Rosh Hashanah is not on Shabbos this year, so we'll do a Mitzvah of Shofar, just for the record. So maybe we'll talk about some Yom Tovim ideas in the upcoming weeks. And you should have a wonderful night. Yeah. Okay.